Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPN
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and you're in for another jam-packed action-adventure show today. Mr. Marty Martino is on the other coast checking out things down there.
That's right.
Yeah. You got any truckers trying to drive you off the road or anybody looking for freedom down there?
Not that I've seen, but I was just at a rock concert. So, yeah, I didn't notice any truck convoys or anything like that. No.
Well, they're probably all at the concert with you.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably true.
I didn't know any of those bands were still alive. Quiet Riot. Well, they're almost all dead, isn't it true? It's just one left.
Quiet Riot has one member, one original member. Yep. And
Slaughter?
I think Slaughter has at least two original members.
And Rat, there's nobody left in that. That's
yeah, except for the lead singer. Yeah.
Wow, there you go. Yeah. They should all get together, the few members left, and create a band.
They should. It could be a super group.
I don't know if I'd go that far, super. Yeah. Boy, you're pushing it there. It's kind of like leftover group. Come on. Anyway, I'm being mean. I'm in a mean
mood. You are. You're mean. You're in a mean mood.
Yeah. I'm in a mean mood. Well, you know, I have blood tests all day. Doctor stuff. I hate that. Mess at the Warren household.
You feel like a pincushion.
Well, yeah, you know, and then I get needles. No. Okay. let's get serious here. We've got someone on the line here, and he's from Scotland. Okay. So sit up straight and let's do this right. We've got a crime thriller writer here, and his name's Ed James. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe. Yes, you get to say that later. Well, this is interesting. So you're like, you've got a lot of books out here. Now, you seem to be into the, you know, like, let's see, in this last series you've got, it's the Fenchurch crime series. And you've got 9 books, I guess, because it's book 9 here, The Last Thing to Die, that I see. Before we get into that series, how did you get into writing? Period.
So I used to be sort of in, funny you were talking about rock bands and stuff there. I used to be in sort of little small bands and I had the dream of becoming a rock star, and it never happened. And then I sort of I worked with a guy who it was sort of writing and trying to get published, and thought, why don't I try that? And that was as simple as it was. There was no, you can speak to a lot of authors who've been destined to become writers since they were like 5 years old or whatever, but I'm very much, I sort of fell into it. I read quite a lot. It was actually, apart from my parents saying I'm a late starting reader, I used to read comics. That's what got me in American comics, Batman and X-Men and all that kind of stuff. And then I read lots of sci-fi, and then I got into sort of British crime and then a lot of American crime as well. And then, yes, that just, I just started writing a book. It was a dreadful, dreadful first book about a guy in a rock band trying to get a record deal and everything going wrong for him, and nobody was interested in it. And then I did another one, which was a bit more crimey, and nobody was interested in that. And then I wrote the first Scott Cullen book, which would be about 2009. I wrote that, tried to get agents, as you do over here, probably the same system you guys have, certainly then, and nobody, I got a couple of people who were interested in reading the full thing, but nobody who bit. So I just parked it away and got on with my day job for a couple of years, and then the Kindle started kicking off. It was a bit earlier in your side of the pond than over here. It was about 2011. It started being a thing here, really. So 2012, April, is when I published the first of those books. And then it's just been a constant feed of them ever since. So, yeah, it was just a passion for reading the books. And then I was always looking for something that absorbed me and took my creative juices, and that sort of certainly has soaked them all up, as you can see by the number of books I've published.
Well, I wonder, because if you're into the rock band, into the music, that was my side too, but I wonder, do you find that your writing is sometimes an outlet for what you would be doing if you were writing songs?
Yeah, so I was a bass player, but I did a lot more of the production side. So I recorded us, and the second band I was in had lots of sort of drum machines and samplers and synthesizers and all that sort of stuff, and I used to program all that. So that was the sort of immersive side of it. So it was less of the trying to bare my soul and write lyrics and songs and so on. But I wrote quite a lot of music, which I always found quite sort of interesting, and then arranging the stuff and that sort of side of things. Certainly, is how I approached writing, I suppose, that I look at a much more of a sort of screenwriting style structure, all that sort of, side of writing rather than just wheeling, dealing as I go through the book.
So I guess people could expect to get some sort of a, I don't know, how do you put that? Some sort of a meaning in each book. Just like they would in a song.
Yeah. I think that's an important thing. The stuff I talk about with my agent, Alan Guthrie, who won, I think he was nominated for an Edgar way back in the day, but he's now sort of an editor and my agent. And we talk a lot about themes and what's the goal is, I suppose, like similar to writing that perfect song. It's right. What's the perfect novel? What's the sort of thing that's going to make this book sell? So that's what I look for. Is in each book there's a theme, and I think I'm getting better at expressing that. I hope, and also focusing on the character and making them go through the emotional journey, which gives them the something that backs up and reinforces that theme. With a song, you know, you want to get a sort of, there's a more visceral reaction, I suppose, as much from the music as well as the words and the tune that people are, that the singer's singing. Whereas with the book, all I've got is my words, I suppose, the cover and things like that, but you have to have less tools at my disposal. It's just me and my keyboard, trying to express something about myself, I suppose, and about the world.
So is that kind of thing that holds back a writer, do you think, even like yourself, is that it takes time to not only learn to write in a way that people enjoy, but also to be able to express yourself and be comfortable with expressing some of your own feelings?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. It takes, because I've published so many books, and I think one of the things that really helped me is, particularly early days, and it's still very important now, but it's being edited. So working with editors, usually most at the development stage, so that, you know, tearing your story apart and restructuring it. And, you know, I've worked with like so many editors now, and I've learned a lot from each one, and it's been absolutely fascinating. But I think nowadays you get a lot more feedback on your books. With the, if you just look on Amazon, you see, you know, hundreds of reviews, thousands of reviews, thousands of ratings. And when people take the time to sort of comment on your book, it, you know, at the early days it feels like a kick in the teeth, but you get over that when people are criticizing, you're looking for what it is they didn't like about it. If there's a theme that emerges from one book, you've made a mistake probably, or you've just really hacked off a lot of readers, and you don't want to repeat that mistake. So you can learn from that. Going back to the music theme, I've started learning to play drums, which is something I always wanted to do, and now I'm doing it in my 40s. And I was talking to a drum teacher about this, we were talking about how people like the Beatles or Elvis Presley or The Who or, you know, Bob Dylan, the Velvet Underground, they were playing, you know, lots and lots and lots of gigs. So they were playing in front of a big audience all the time, and they got so much feedback, and that sort of fed into their instinctive playing. So a lot of the complex musical things they were actually achieving, they had no idea they were doing it, but they would hit two chords or something and they'd see an audience react in a certain way, and that became part of their instinct. That's certainly what I take from it. So I think that getting that feedback in any sort of creative endeavor is certainly critical, I think, to improving your ability to express yourself.
Only when they're throwing their panties at them.
That's right.
Yeah, we weren't talking about Tom Jones, no.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, you're talking about themes in your fiction, and I just wonder if you found any recurrent themes or motifs that tend to show up, and if they show up deliberately or if it's more unconscious as you're writing your novels.
Yeah, I think one of the things that definitely comes across is, even though I'm writing generally about police officers, there's a lot of the office politics comes across in every book, and I try to approach it in different ways. So the Cullen books, his boss Bain, D.I. Brian Bain, is very overbearing, very arrogant, and that's something you would see in a particular office environment, which I've certainly experienced. The Fenchurch one is, he's much more of a reluctant participant and all that, so he's like trying to just do the job, and there's all this office politics going off in other areas of the London Metropolitan Police Force. And the Vicky Dodds books, which are set in Dundee, it's much more a collegiate thing, so people get on with each other. So the tension comes from what they do, which can annoy people, but the intention is that they're actually friends rather than enemies, which the Cullen books certainly have more than a share of. Yeah.
Well, that's, so when you talk about British and American crime, mm-hmm. do you have to write them differently? Is there a different way of writing each of those types of crime?
Yeah, so I've written three novels set in Seattle, which were FBI thrillers about the child abduction unit, rapid deployment unit in the FBI. And they're much more, I think American audiences tend to want a bit more of an action thing, or they want more of a PI thing. So if you look at someone like Michael Connelly's Bosch books, the common theme people talk about with them is they're not really like a traditional British police procedural. They're much more like he's a private investigator in the old Chandler mold, but he's operating inside the police force. Whereas if you look at someone like Stuart McBride or Mark Billingham or Ian Rankin, who are the big British male crime writers, their books are very different and much more focused around the actual process of being a police officer with a team working for you or working with a team. So there's very much a different way of approaching it. But I think the FBI ones, they're much more action led than and more like cinematic thrillery type things than I'd previously done. But they were probably more close to the British thing with the investigative element going on in there, and also the sidekicks and all those kind of people, the bosses, the bit of office politics that I'd tend to throw into my books. Yeah.
Well, so you seem to you cover a lot of police procedurals and stuff you talk that's talked about with you. Is this something you've always just been interested in, or were you trying to be a cop, or were you maybe a criminal that just? I mean, where do you go when you want to know what goes on in these detectives' minds and the way they behave?
I've got friends who are police officers who are very good at answering the stupid questions I come up with, and sometimes reading through the books. And given an impression on it. But generally, every time a reader's got in touch with me, they said, how do you know what it's like being a cop in Edinburgh or whatever? You totally nailed it. And it's like, I don't. I have no interest in being a police officer. They're just people. You know, that's the thing. Police officers are people, and you get good ones and bad ones. And you seem to have a bit of a problem with having far too many of the bad ones over there. Not that there's... We've got a shortage of that over here, but it's much more of a thing. Just simply, I think the way the police forces have evolved separately in Britain and America, yours are much more sort of militarized from a certain basis of political reality, whereas ours are much, much smaller forces, more just law, just the sort of law and order kind of aspect of it. And I think the writing about the detectives as opposed to what we'd call a beat bobby or you'd call a patrol cop, they tend to be more heroic figures because they're trying to achieve some form of justice. Whereas if you're writing about someone who's like a beat cop, that's where I think a lot more of the negative behaviours in police officers come from and you are exhibited. And that's not the sort of books that I write or want to write or want to read about. But I think there's a lot of people are going to write a lot more about that.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing to avoid these times, right? Like mm-hmm. nowadays, because there's so much, it divides people because no matter what, you're mm-hmm. going to lose half the country.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And sometimes you can lose all the country because you've got it so wrong. I think that people want to read a book to escape, you know, there's enjoyment. And you can put in little bits of your personal worldview in there. But if you go too far, you just alienate everyone because it's a polemic they're reading rather than some form of escape. So it's good to sort of thread the message, I suppose, through with all the entertainment side of it. But you're there to make people turn the pages and find out what happened and understand the deepest mystery that's going on here.
Yeah, so I think the heart of it has to be about the mystery or mm-hmm. the storyline that you do, and not so much about whether there's good cops or bad cops or starting yeah. to get into that, because that's you're asking for trouble in these current times. You know, people just, you know.
There's important books being written on that subject, and they're just very different to what this sort of thing I would write.
Yeah, it has to be. Now, I noticed in this, the last one, A Hill to Die On, I think that was book 8. Now, Fenchurch is Chloe Fenchurch, and that's a female detective, right?
So she's the daughter of the main cop. So the main guy in the series is D.I. Simon Fenchurch, and Chloe is his daughter. So all the way back to the first book in that series, there's a whole load of spoilers about to happen here, but she was abducted as a child, and the first three books are about their attempts to recover her. The first book, The Hope That Kills, he's in a really negative place, has been obsessed about trying to find her, where his wife's moved on and they've divorced. And it's as much about their relationship as the central plot. And then over the course of the 8 books, they've got reconciled, and it's been a challenge for them, I think it's fair to say. But by this point, the 8th book, Chloe's now a police officer training in the Met, and finding it, she's done it, so an idealistic cop, and finding that the reality doesn't quite match up with her idealism.
Yeah, sort of like me. how do you write it from that point of view of the daughter, for instance, like Chloe? How do you get into that person's head when, of course, you're not a woman, at least that we know of, and a daughter of a cop? So yeah. I just wonder what your process is to getting into someone like that.
I think it's as much homing in on their worldview. You know, what does she see? I mean, all the stuff I've put on the page that's happened to her, plus the stuff I haven't put on, you refer to that. So looking at where she's been, and that is going to give her a sort of a worldview that makes her see things are coloured in a certain way. And the sort of events that have happened in particularly the 4th to 7th books, make her, have flaws, I suppose, but she's a give her a sort of heroic edge. But in terms of the voice, I don't really know how I do it. That's the thing. I'm a like hardcore pantser, no, a plotter, as they say, rather than a pantser. And I outline thoroughly, extremely, and that's why I produce so many books. But sometimes I'm absolutely baffled by the things that I can put into my books. So I've been able to sort of write in that voice of a late teenage woman, girl at that age. And a lot of the feedback I get is that it reads authentically. It's very, even like someone at that age, and I have no idea what kids listen to, or that is even music. I'm getting to that age. But, you know, I think for advice for other authors, I would say it's just write the character. They're all people. Find their voice, find what they've been through, and that'll impact the way they see things, how they trust, who they don't. And do they, you know, someone who's been abducted as a child, they're going to see a lot of threats, for instance, in the world, and that's going to color their view. So they're maybe on hyper alert a lot of the time.
Well, you mentioned voice. Do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear Chloe and your other characters in your head? I just want to know if you're hearing voices.
Yeah.
We can help you with that, maybe.
Yeah, I'm on drugs for that. I think I'm not someone who writes a lot of an inner thought. I tend to write, you know, they're all third person past tense, limited. Books, so it's not like there's a you're hearing her in her head. Occasionally throw in some thoughts, reaction, and so on. But the way the characters talk, I always try to make sure each character has a distinct voice when they speak. It's as distinct as the actions they do. And also, I think when you've got characters, so a lot of the books I've written have been single point of view. So and this is the first Fenchurch book where it's been shown from anyone's eyes but him. So I think showing it from her viewpoint has been an interesting one. And I think actually thinking about now, I approached each of her scenes in a different way than I would have done his. So that they have a different flow and a different energy to them. And there's a bit more pace and a bit more youthful exuberance in those. And I think if you look at the opening chapter is from her point of view about her discovering a body. And that's that happens quite rapidly. There's a bit of slapstick comedy that goes sour and goes quite tragic quite quickly. And then there's quite a lot of different locations in there. So whereas one of his scenes would tend to be more sedate and sitting around an office table or walking or driving, hers are running. There's a lot of stuff that I do to differentiate each character in that way when I've got multiple points of view on the go.
So are you, do you get really into your character then as you write them? Like, are you wearing a dress and the whole thing? And do you follow through? Or is this just sort of, it's just looking at people as the basic person and going from there?
Yeah. I mean, I've written four books from the perspective of Vicky Dodds, who's a female officer. And I think the second Craig Hunter book was half from his girlfriend's perspective, who was a female cop as well. So it's, and then the FBI books, quite a lot of the those other points of view were female. But yeah, it's just men and women are just people. There's as much variety in women as there is in men. Find that who that character is and write about them. What's their experience? How do they see things? How do they feel about things? Usually characters will have a misbelief. So there's whatever they've gone through in their lives, they'll see things in a certain way and they'll act in that way. And I think one of the things that can differentiate a hero and a villain is whether they change as a result of the story. If someone misbelieves something that causes them to do something, if they can accept that that's a mistake and they should do something, I think people have a lot more sympathy than a villain who misbelieves something that makes them do horrific things.
And so on the main character, like I believe that's Simon's her father.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like the main character throughout the whole series.
Mm-hmm.
Who is he? Is that a lot of you or a lot of what you is that character doing a lot of things you'd like to try and do?
No, he's probably the least like me, I think, of the characters I've written. When I started out with the Scott Collin books, he's one that he's maybe the most similar to me. So that was, started writing that about 13 years ago. And as a lot younger guy, I started doing it. He had a bit more of the brash impulsiveness and ambition I had at that age. Whereas, and I think when you're sort of writing a series, you look at the, especially detective books, you look at the tropes of the genre. And with British police procedurals, they tend to be older cops with difficult marriages, bad relationships with children, a classic car, all that kind of stuff. And I inverted that and made him really young, not married, no kids, and his car was rubbish. So all the development happened on the page rather than sort of a backstory or whatever. Whereas with Fenchurch,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Which I actually tackled that on much more. So he had the difficult backstory and all the personal trauma and all that kind of stuff. But he's a lot less like me. I mean, I am a bit of a grumpy sod at times, but nowhere near as bad as him. But then I haven't had my child abducted and been an officer in the Metropolitan Police. So, yeah.
No, where does the comedy come from? Like, I like a lot of old 40s and 50s mysteries and detectives. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, like there was a lot of comedy in it, kind of a way of the detective being kind of a smartass, you know, kind of in a way. And I enjoy that, but where do you get it from, and kind of what is it, do you sort of hope people kind of smile throughout the book, even though it's a mystery or a thriller?
I hope so. I mean, one of the biggest influences I have is reading a lot of books from that period, like Ed McBain would be the classic example, who defined a lot of this stuff. And his books, there's a lot of wry humor in there, and you know, they act like people, they're ribbing each other and so on. But in terms of humor in my books, I think because you're writing about murders or you're writing about abductions or assaults or whatever, there's a lot of dark stuff in there. Whenever you read books or watch stuff that's just got one tone like that, it just becomes boring, basically. So having in multiple different streams of emotion and given an emotional range means that I think the darker stuff hits harder. But also, I think when you're writing these sort of series books, you know, there's a what they call parasocial phenomenon going on. So like, for instance, a podcast would be an example of that, where you guys will have people listening to on the radio or listening to the podcast on their phones or whatever. But they'll think they know you, even though they don't, because they sit and hear you and you talk about, you know, the stuff you talk about. But it goes one way, because there's a lot of information you put out, they soak up. That's the same phenomenon that applies with books as well, even though they're not necessarily associating with me, they're associating with the characters. But what you want is that whenever one of my new books comes out, they want to spend more time with those characters. So yeah, they've gone through some difficult stuff, but there are people who make them laugh or make them smile, and also when they're sharing the harder times, that they've got more have a rapport and more empathy for their situations because they like them. And I think that's the key to long-term success for book series, is that people just want to pick it up to spend time with people they've enjoyed spending time with in the past.
When you write humor, you know, there's something to be said about like comedic timing. When people, you know, go on stage, do stand-up comedy or whatever. Do you feel like there's a need for timing or rhythm when you're putting comedy or humor into prose?
There's different types of it, I suppose. Yeah, some of it's just a dry one-liner retort, you know, where your amazingly witty detective is you know, is putting someone down or just has a snarky wee comment back. But I think when you're trying, like, I think you're getting it more of a sort of a comedic set piece, like that sort of first chapter in The Hill to Die On. There's a bit of slapstick in there, and that's quite tough to get right, I think, especially in the written word. You know, if you're filming someone falling over, you know, you've got the masters like Charlie Chaplin, and then any number of imitators since, who, you know, you point a camera and mess about in a very amusing way. But with a book, I think it's about showing intent and then subverting that intent and then twisting it even further. So they're trying to open a fridge door. Someone kicks them in the back of the knee, they fall in, the fridge door opens, and then all the bottles of what we'd call juice fall out, what you call a soda. So they're covered in cans of Coke and all that kind of stuff. When they're trying to get up to chase after the guy, they're falling over all the cans of Coke or Sprite or Iron Brew. So it's a lot of rhythms. Is a tough one to get in fiction. It's one of the most, I think, neglected bits of writing craft, is that a lot of people can write very stilted rhythmically, so it's like 1 2 3, 1 2 3, 1 2 3, 1 2 3, and it just becomes a sort of numbing, monotonous thing. There's, you need that variety with sentence length, so you can have like 1 2 3, 1 2 3, it gives you sort of, you know, a nice tension, but then open it up with a really sort of long flowing description, for instance, and it keeps people on their toes, keeps their brains ticking over as well.
Well, that's if they have a brain. I mean, I seem to have an issue with that. But, you know, now, so this might sound a little bit of a weird question, but it's just that after hundreds of fiction writers, I get so many different descriptions of who the characters are to them. You know, I've heard writers tell me that it's like their children, it's like their family, it's like, you know, I get all that sort of stuff. Do you sort of put your characters in the same thing? Are they real to you? And how do you describe them?
Are they real to me? I think so. I kind of have a love-hate relationship, I suppose, with them, though. They're closer to really close friends, you know, the way they have that, or family. How do I describe them? Like some of them, like I say, some of them I just don't think I'd get on with in person. You know, I think they'd think I was too cowardly or just this daft wee author, or big author, big lump. Whereas others I think would be more sympathetic. I think Vicky Dodds would be more, would give me more time and would want to get to know people. She's a bit of a kinder person, whereas I think Fenchurch would just see right through me very quickly, and Colin would be up to no good, no doubt.
Well, I'm wondering, have any of your characters ever done anything maybe to surprise you? Have they kind of just started rebelling against the plot? Does that happen?
Usually when that happens, it's because I've made a mess of the outline just not thought something through. In terms of behavior, though, yeah, one of the guys I loved writing so much is a real, what we'd call a Marmite character. I don't know if that translates across the Atlantic, but Marmite's this, I suppose, it's a breakfast thing people would put on their toast. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's, it's a yeast extract, and I think it tastes absolutely vile. But some people absolutely swear by it. So it's a real love-hate thing. The Marmite character's Brian Bain, and he constantly surprised me. And he was he was sort of the funny one, but he was a nasty, nasty person. So he, you know, he's not a good person, but, you know, he saw the funny in things, and he would just come up with stuff that's obviously some dark part of my psyche, but he would surface that. I remember particularly earlier, I remember one time I was getting a butt on a bus to work because the train was cancelled, and I was just sitting with I printed the book out, and I was just going through editing it on paper, and I got to one line, and I just got myself into fits of giggles about something I'd written. And one of the things I find is that I can remember lots of factual information. So I can remember who did what in which book. And I can remember, you know, so like when I go back to a new series, it's just a new book in an old series. It's just like falling off a log. I just pick it up so quickly. But then there's whole things I just can't remember I've written, like little funny things that just absolutely tickle me, but I can't remember writing. And that's one of the joys, I suppose, as well, is forgetting what you've written and liking it.
Well, don't worry. It won't be long, and that'll be that way with everything.
Yeah.
Don't even remember where you are. You know. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned structure and outlining. So are you doing that in each book? Do you kind of know where it's going to end? But when you get a series of 8 books, do you sort of have this all outlined somewhere in your head, or somewhere that you know where, how it begins and kind of how it's going to end, but you just kind of work out the details on the way? Like, how is that outline structure work for you?
So that's one of the things I've had difficulties with, that I do outline each book using sort of various dramatic techniques, usually from screenwriting. They're very big on structure in that world. And it's, you know, you get a lot of really good stuff that way. But what I've found is, having written each book, I've done it piecemeal. So I've written myself into so many corners, not in a book, but over the, oh God, when I have to go pick up the 8th book in that series, I don't like where I've actually put the cop or the main character. He's like working in the drug squad now, and I don't want him doing that. So I have to think very quickly about how I get him out of that. And also the sort of interpersonal, you know, romantic stuff, I've not really thought through longer term. So he's in a relationship I don't want him to be in. So that has to come out. And one of the things I'm doing, focusing on just now, is there's a new series I'm developing, which will hopefully get at least one book out this year. I've done an outline for the first book, but what I found is that one of the things that blocked me from actually writing that is what I've wanted to know where it's going. So I'm doing what they call in the TV world the series Bible. So big, you know, TV shows like Lost or 24 or Star Trek or any of that, they all have a series Bible, so it'll outline a few bits about the characters and a few episodes, and here's where this character's going to go, here's what they're going to go through. So that's what I'm focusing on with this new series, so that I'm finding it actually works really well, because what I thought was going to be the second book is actually the third book, and they swapped the order, and it's leading into some really nice stuff in the fourth book, which I'm building up over time. So taking time to let myself outline across multiple books has been a real, well, hopefully it'll pay off. I don't want to curse it, but you know, taking that time to do it is definitely something I wish I'd done for my previous books. I think it'd be richer for it. I think it's a good discipline to get into if you're developing a series that's going to, you know, is going to be 3-4 books long. Spend time thinking where you want that character to get to by the end of the 3 or 4 books, And then you can have an easy jumping off point if you don't want to write any more because you've closed that story. But if you want to pick it up again, you've already done the work and you know where they are now.
Now, in your series, the people do not have to read them all in order. Someone could pick up like book 8 now and read it and go back if they want.
It's always the sort of the thing I focus on being able to do that. I think I have probably a harder continuity with my books. I'm almost like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You have to watch 27 films to understand what's going on in this TV show. There's a lot of continuity with it, but one of the reasons I work with different editors is to go with someone who's never read any of my books before. So they're going at it cold. Does that book 8 or 9 in a series, does it work standalone? Or if someone who's like not edited me for like 5 or 6 books and they pick this up, can they follow it? What's going on? And there's a lot of the prevailing wisdom is that you want readers to start at book 1, but you can't control readers. So, you know, if a reader starts at book 8, you want them to, go back to the start and pick the whole series up and catch up with themselves. Because that's when I got into crime fiction, to reading it, it was with Ian Rankin, who's the pretty much the preeminent British crime writer with his Rebus novels. And the first one that hit big for him was the 8th one. And that's the first one I read back in 1998. And then I went back and read all the previous books, but it didn't have, I don't remember at the time being absolutely bamboozled that you had to know this person, this person, and this person for any of it to make sense. So I think that was a great template to be able to follow. That you don't have to pick up book 1 to understand the characters. You also want to show something new with the characters in each book as well. It doesn't have to be Angela Lansbury in Murder, She Wrote, going to a new town and there's another suspicious murder and no character development for her.
So when you're writing, can you just turn it on and write? So if you've got like a 4-hour window, you can just sit down and write? Or do you have to be in a particular mood to do the job?
I am very, one of the things I'm good at is actually just sitting down and getting through the work. That's what I do. It goes back to when I started out. I was working full time and I had a commute that was an hour each way on the train. So I used to get there, stand on the platform, I knew exactly where the train stopped so that I could get into a certain bit, elbow everyone out the way, grab a table, put my laptop out and headphones on, and that was me for another hour of just writing. And that's stayed with me. So I get up, do my look at my sales stats, and then just get straight on with the writing process, and I'll work through till lunchtime. And then take my dog out for a walk up some brutal hills around here in the Scottish borders.
Well, there you have it. You know what to look for. Ed walking around the hills with his dog. So if you had to pick one book of someone that has never heard of you or never read your books, and you were to pick one book to give them to kind of get your style of writing, which one would you tell them to get?
I think I would give them, that's a very difficult question because there's so many books published. It's not to say there's so many that would answer that question. I think the best one is the one that's coming out in May, which is a standalone. It's a psychological thriller. So it's slightly different from my existing books. It's called Lost Cause, and it's about an author who's struggled to finish his book for 5 years, which is not an affliction I've ever had because my problem is I've probably published too many, not enough. But his daughter goes missing in the Scottish Highlands and he goes up to find her and he has to rely on his ex-wife, who's a police officer, to help him find her and track her down, and lots of dark mystery going on up there. That's the one I'd recommend because it's got no series connotations, but it's also got the huge investigative and element and a lot of character work. But if people are looking to get into anime series, the first Fenchurch one, The Hope That Kills, is probably the one I would point them to. It's got the most, the strongest character work, I think, of the books I've done.
Do you think you get better with each book you do?
Yeah, well, so one of the things Alan Guthrie, my agent, says is if you can look at one of your old books and not want to tear it apart, then you've stagnated as a writer. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. I've actually been quite bad at going through back and editing old books, and it's something I'm trying to stop doing, just because you can always look at it. It's like Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin remastering his back catalogue every 5 years or whatever. you've got to stop fiddling and just let it be. But I personally think I always try to do something new with each book and learn something new. So I think that makes me a better writer, whether my readers agree with me or not, I don't know. But I like to feel like I'm developing and I'm more capable of expressing what I'm trying to express, if that makes sense.
When you've finished a novel or even a chapter, do you do anything to relax and recharge in between?
Another chapter.
You just get on with it.
It depends. I tend to sprint, really. So if I'm in the zone, I'll just keep going until I can't do any more. And then it's like, right, I'm just going to get out of the house and go and, like I say, walk the dog. That's my relaxation. So I had a few health scares a few years ago and got myself quite fit. So, where I live is, lots of, big hills, so I take the dog up them every day to just get my heart pounding and my feet pounding, and that does sort of take a lot of the pent up tension. And one of the things about being a writer is you're sitting on your bahookie all the time, so you know that's a sedentary lifestyle. So getting out and doing something is getting out into the fresh air as well, into nature. You know, I walk up trails, we call it forestry commission land here, so there's lots of old trees that have been grown since the 60s, and you can just walk amongst them on these big old paths. But getting out into the nature and sort of smelling the fresh air and not seeing a soul for hours at a time, that's great, and gets my head clear as much as my heart. Yeah,
it's good to stay away from people. They're awful.
Yeah.
Personally, they're just awful people, creatures. Dogs are good.
Yeah.
People, well. Now, so speaking of people and how awful they are, do you interact with people on social media? Are you into that? Do you have a website? How do you kind of like to connect with readers?
Yeah, so there's quite a few things I do. I tried TikTok last week and it just was, oh my God. that is the death of civilization, that, yeah. Right there. Look at that. Just talk about sensory overload. It absolutely bamboozled me, but I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and I post a lot of photos from my many dog walks on Instagram. They're all my handles are Ed James Author, which my website is edjamesauthor.co.uk or edjames.co.uk and edjamesauthor.com. And I've started doing I've done it for a few years now, actually, a Substack newsletter, which doesn't have many people on it, but I just write it every week as a little. So you can hear my dog drinking water in the background.
Well,
so she's obviously not that impressed. It's a Substack newsletter. It's just I write what I've done this week and what I'm going to do the next week, and it just keeps me sort of focused on and accountable to myself, I suppose. And I think a lot of people reply to it saying they like seeing that side of the, or seeing how the sausage is made, as we'd say over here. Writing is a tough business than publishing. It can be brutal psychologically because you've got so many ups and downs. It's not just a case of sitting down and writing. It's coping with the business side of it that I think people don't quite appreciate. So hopefully they can see certainly how my twisted brain ticks in the administrative bureaucracy world.
Yeah, well, it is. It's very emotional at times, right? You know.
Yeah.
You know, you get that bad review and you're going to, oh, I'm going to kill this person. Put them in my next book, you know.
Yeah.
You know, no. So we'll have that linked up, of course, on the website and stuff like that. You know, how was COVID for you with writing? Did it sort of interfere with your groove, so to speak?
No, it was just basically let everyone else in the world see what it's like being me because you had to stay inside all the time. And you got out over here. We got out for an hour a day exercise. I wrote quite a lot during that time, and published quite a lot. And I wrote some books that were set during the pandemic, just to document a lot of the stuff that was going on for myself. They're kind of a bit more niche. Those books are sort of about 45,000 words, so they're a bit shorter than other stuff. But you know, I thought it was my way of documenting it, and some people really like them, so I'm quite pleased with that. But yeah, the start of 2020 was a difficult time for me professionally, so I spent a lot of time focusing and refocusing my brain, and I think now 2 years later I'm kind of at the end of that cycle of shoring things up, I suppose. So there's a lot of the global catastrophe going on is impacted by the personal catastrophe as well.
Yeah. No, I know. I just, everybody feels it differently.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. You know, yeah. It's just interesting to see if something, you know, when it's stressful outside, if it kind of works its way into your writing, if it gets a little darker maybe, or a little bit more.
Yeah,
unknown.
I think I actually got my work writing a bit lighter. I think
yeah.
I think with the rise, and this is probably going to alienate half your audience, but the rise of the sort of populists in 2016, which was Trump on your side and the Brexit vote on our side, I found those difficult times, and I was quite angry about a lot of that. And a lot of that anger was channeled into my books. And when I look back at some of that stuff, I can see there's a bit of anger in there as well. But yeah, the stuff now, I tend to sort of have a bit more kindness to myself, I think, and a bit more levity, and I'm kind of accepting that the world is a certain way and I can't change it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. It's just, I think things like this are always around, always have been, especially in our lifetime. Mm-hmm. And it's just how much of it you see or notice, or how, you know, how much of it's out there at times. A lot of times it seems, that we thought it was gone at times and it keeps coming back. So I think it's just kind of a.
Yeah. And there's a certain, you can sort of understand a certain element with the people. The way people vote are in a certain way, that there's an anger at the world that they have. Some of them are just nasty people, I think. Yeah. But I think it's realizing that they can be easily led by demagogues, I suppose. That's the depressing part, that people fall for confidence tricks still. Yeah.
No end,
No, never ends.
No, it doesn't seem to, Well, it's been a great conversation.
Yeah, I've had a great time. Thanks.
Of course, we're talking about the latest book in the Fenchurch crime thriller, Book 8, A Hill to Die On. And the author's been our guest, Ed James. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me again. It's been, I can now say that it was great fun. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Ed.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.